or women didn't. Most of them were wearing jeans and dark shirts. Except for the sport coat man, who just stood back and watched, they moved quickly and purposefully, like folks on a mission. To Annie, they looked sort of military, and this impression was confirmed in short order. Two of the men and one of the younger women opened the back doors of the vans. The man took a long steel box from one of them. From the back of another van came holster belts, which the woman handed around to everyone except for the sport coat man, another man with short blonde hair, and the woman in the flowered dress. The steel box was opened, and from this came a couple of long guns that were not hunting rifles. They were what Annie Ledoux thought of as school shooter guns. The woman in the flowered dress put a small handgun in her purse. The man beside her stuck a bigger one in his belt at the small of his back, then dropped the tail of his shirt over it. The others holstered up. They looked like a raiding party. Hell, they were a raiding party. Annie didn't see how they could be anything else. A normally wired person, one who didn't get her nightly news from George Allman, for instance, might have merely stared in dismayed confusion, wondering what on earth a bunch of armed men and women might be doing in a sleepy South Carolina town where there was only a single bank and that one locked up for the night. A normally wired person might have whipped out her cell phone and called 911. Annie, however, was not a normally wired person, and she knew exactly what these armed men and women, at least 10 of them and maybe more, were up to. They hadn't come in the black SUV she would have expected, but they were here for the boy. Of course they were. Calling 911 to alert the folks in the sheriff's station wasn't an option in any case, because she wouldn't have carried a cell phone if she'd been able to afford one. Cell phones shot radiation into your head. Any fool knew that. And besides, they could track you that way. So Annie continued along the path, running now, until she reached the back of the Dupre barbershop two buildings down. A rickety flight of stairs led to the apartment above. Annie climbed them as fast as she could, holding up her serape and the long skirt beneath so she wouldn't trip and take a tumble. At the top, she hammered on the door until she saw Corbett Denton through the ragged curtain, shuffling toward her with his big belly leading the way. He pushed the curtain aside and peered out, his bald head gleaming beneath the light of the kitchen's fly-specked overhead globe.
Annie, what do you want? I'm not giving you anything to eat if that's...
There's men, she said, panting to catch her breath. She could have added there were also women, but just saying men sounded more fearsome, at least to her. They're parked behind the gym.
Go away, Annie. I don't have time for your foolish...
There's a boy. I think those men mean to get to the station and take him away. I think there's gonna be shooting.
What the hell are you...
Please, drummer, please! They had machine guns, I think, and that boy, he's a nice boy. He opened the door.
Let me smell your breath. She seized him by the front of his pajama shirt.
I haven't had a drink in 10 years. Please, drummer, they came for the boy.
He sniffed, frowning now. No booze. Are you hallucinating?
No.
You said machine guns. Do you mean automatic rifles, like AR-15s? Drummer Denton was beginning to look interested.
Yes. No, I don't know, but you have guns. I know you do. You should bring them.
You're out of your mind, he said. And that was when Annie began to cry. Drummer had known her most of his life. Had even gone stepping with her a time or two when they were much younger. And he had never seen her cry. She really believed something was going on, and Drummer decided what the hell. He'd only been doing what he did every night, which was thinking about the basic stupidity of life. All right, let's go look.
And your guns? You'll bring your guns?
Hell no, I said we're gonna look.
Drummer, please!
Look, he said, that's all I'm willing to do. Take it or leave it. With no other choice,
Orphan Annie took it.
25.
Oh, my dear God, what am I looking at?
Wendy's words were muffled, because she had a hand over her mouth. No one answered. They were staring at the screen, Luke as frozen with wonder and horror as the rest. The back half of back half, Ward A, Gorky Park, was a long, high room that looked to Luke like the sort of abandoned factory where shootouts always happened at the end of the action movies he and Rolf had liked to watch 1,000 years ago, back when he had been a real kid. It was lit by fluorescent bars behind wire mesh that cast shadows and gave the ward an eerie, undersea look. There were long, narrow windows covered by heavier mesh. There were no beds, only bare mattresses. Some of these had been pushed into the aisles. A couple were overturned, and one leaned drunkenly against a bare cinder block wall. It was splotched with yellow gunk that might have been vomit. A long gutter filled with running water ran alongside one cinder block wall, where a stenciled motto read, "You are saviors." A girl, naked except for a pair of dirty socks, squatted over this gutter with her back against the wall and her hands on her knees. She was defecating. There was that rasping sound as cloth rubbed across the phone in Maureen's pocket, where it was perhaps taped in place, and the image was momentarily blotted out as the slit the camera was peering through closed. When it opened again, the girl was walking away in a kind of drunken amble, and her shit was being carried down the gutter. A woman in a brown housekeeper's uniform was using a rinse-and-vac to clean up what might have been more puke, more shit, spilled food, God knew what. She saw Maureen, waved, and said something none of them could pick up, not just because of the rinse-and-vac, but because Gorky Park was a loony bin of mingled voices and cries. A girl was doing cartwheels down one of the ragged aisles. A boy in dirty underpants with pimples on his face and smeary glasses sliding down his nose walked past. He was yelling, "Ya-ya, ya-ya, ya-ya," and hitting the top of his head on every emphasized syllable. Luke remembered Kalisha mentioning a boy with zits and glasses on his first day at the Institute, that had been. "Seems like Petey's been gone forever, but it was only last week," she had said. And here that boy was. Or what was left of him. "Little John," Luke murmured. "I think that's his name. Pete Little John." No one heard him. They were staring at the screen as if hypnotized. Across from the gutter, used for eliminatory purposes, was a long trough on steel legs. Two girls and a boy were standing there. The girls were using their hands to scoop some brown gunk into their mouths. Tim, staring at this with disbelief and sickened wonder, thought it looked like Mapo, the cereal of his childhood. The boy was bent over with his face in the stuff, his hands held out at his sides, snapping his fingers. A few other kids just lay on their mattresses, staring up at the ceiling, their faces tattooed with the shadows of the mesh. As Maureen walked toward the rinse-and-vac woman, presumably to take over her job, the picture cutout and the blue screen came back. They waited to see if Maureen would appear again in her wing-back chair, perhaps to offer some further explanation, but there was nothing else. "My God, what was that?" Frank Potter asked. "The back half of back half," Luke said. He was whiter than ever. "What kind of people would put children in a monsters?" Luke said. He got up, then put a hand to his head and staggered. Tim grabbed him. "Are you going to faint?" "No, I don't know. I need to get outside. I need to breathe some fresh air. It's like the walls are closing in." Tim looked at Sheriff John, who nodded.
"Take him out in the alley. See if you can get him right."
"I'll come with you," Wendy said. "You'll need me to open the door anyway." The door at the far end of the holding area had big white capital letters printed across it. "Emergency exit, alarm will sound." Wendy used a key from her ring to turn off the alarm. Tim hit the push bar with the heel of his hand and used the other to lead Luke, not staggering now but still horribly pale, out into the alley. Tim knew what PTSD was, but had never seen it except on TV. He was seeing it now, in this boy who wouldn't be old enough to shave for another 3 years. "Don't step on any of Annie's stuff," Wendy said. "Especially not her air mattress. She wouldn't thank you for that." Luke didn't ask what an air mattress, two backpacks, a three-wheeled grocery cart, and a rolled-up sleeping bag were doing in the alley. He walked slowly toward Main Street, taking deep breaths, pausing once to bend over and grip his knees. "Any better?" Tim asked.
"My friends are going to let them out," Luke said, still bent over.
"Let who out?"
Wendy asked.
"Those..."
She didn't know how to finish. It didn't matter because Luke didn't seem to hear her.
"I can't see them, but I know. I don't understand how I can, but I do. I think it's the Avester. Avery, I mean. Kalisha is with him. And Nikki. George. God, they're so strong. So strong together."
Luke straightened up and began walking again. As he stopped at the mouth of the alley, Main Street's 6 streetlights came on. He looked at Tim and Wendy, amazed.
"Did I do that?"
"No, honey,"
Wendy said, laughing a little.
"It's just the regular time. Let's go back inside now. You need to drink one of Sheriff John's Cokes."
She touched his shoulder. Luke shook her off.
"Wait."
A hand-holding couple was crossing the deserted street. The man had short blonde hair. The woman was wearing a dress with flowers on it.
26. The power the kids generated dropped when Nikki let go of Kalisha's and George's hands, but only a little. Because the others were gathered behind the Ward A door now, and they were providing most of the power. It's like a seesaw, Nick thought. As the ability to think goes down, TP and TK goes up. And the ones behind that door have almost no minds left.
"That's right," Avery said. "That's how it works. They're the battery."
Nikki's head was clear, absolutely no pain. Looking at the others, he guessed they were the same. Whether the headaches would come back or when was impossible to say. For now, he was only grateful. No more need for the sparkler. They were past that now. They were riding the hum. Nikki bent over the caretakers who had tased themselves into unconsciousness and started going through their pockets. He found what he was looking for and handed it to Kalisha, who handed it to Avery.
"You do it," she said.
Avery Dixon, who should have been home eating supper with his parents after another hard day of being the smallest boy in his 5th grade class, took the orange key card and pressed it to the sensor panel. The lock thumped and the door opened. The residents of Gorky Park were clustered on the other side like sheep huddled together in a storm. They were dirty, mostly undressed, dazed. Several of them were drooling. Petey Littlejohn was going, "Yah-yah, yah-yah, yah-yah," as he thumped his head. "They are never coming back," Avery thought. "Their gears are too stripped to recover. Maybe Iris, too."
"George, but the rest of us might have a chance."
"Yes." Kalisha, knowing it was cold, also knowing it was necessary, "in the meantime, we can use them."
"What now?"
Katie asked.
"What now? What now?"
For a moment, none of them answered, because none of them knew. Then Avery spoke up.
"Front half. Let's get the rest of the kids and get out of here."
"Helen."
"And go where?"
An alarm began to blare, whoop, whoop, whooping and rising and falling cycles. None of them paid any attention.
"We'll worry about that later," Nikki said.
He joined hands with Kalisha and George again.
"First, let's get some payback. Let's do some damage. Anyone got a problem with that?"
No one did. Hands once more linked, the 11 who had begun the revolt started back down the hall toward the back half lounge and the elevator lobby beyond. The residents of Ward A followed in a kind of zombie shuffle, perhaps drawn by the magnetism of children who could still think. The hum had dropped to a drone, but it was there. Avery Dixon reached out, searching for Luke, hoping to find him in a place too far away to be of any help to them, because that would mean at least one of the Institute's child slaves was safe. There was a good chance the rest of them were going to die, because the staff of this hellhole would do anything to keep them from escaping. Anything. 27.
Trevor Stackhouse was in his office down the hall from Mrs. Sigsby's, pacing up and down because he was too wired to sit, and would remain that way until he heard from Julia. Her news might be good or bad, but any news would be better than this waiting. A telephone rang, but it was neither the traditional jingle of the landline or the brrrt brrrt of his box phone. It was the imperative double honk of the red security phone. The last time it had rung was when the shit show with those twins and the cross boy had gone down in the cafeteria. Stackhouse picked it up, and before he could say a word, Dr. Hallis was gibbering in his ear.
"They're out. The ones who watch the movies, for sure, and I think the Gorks are out, too. They've heard at least three of the caretakers. No, four. Corinne says she thinks Phil Chaffetz is dead.
Shut up!" Stackhouse yelled into the phone. And then, when he was sure, no, not sure, just hopeful, that he had Heckle's attention, he said, "Put your thoughts in order and tell me what happened." Hallis, shocked back to an approximation of his once-upon-a-time rationality, told Stackhouse what he had seen. As he was nearing the end of his story, the Institute's general alarm began to go off. "Christ, did you turn that on, Everett?"
"No, no, not me. It must have been Joanne. Dr. James, she was in the crematory. She goes there to meditate."
Stackhouse was almost sidetracked by the bizarre image this raised in his mind. Dr. Jekyll sitting cross-legged in front of the oven door, perhaps praying for serenity. And then he forced his mind back to the situation at hand. The back-half children had raised some kind of half-assed mutiny. How could it have happened? It had never happened before. And why now? Heckle was still talking, but Stackhouse had heard all he needed. "Listen to me, Everett. Get every orange card you can find and burn them, okay? Burn them."
"How? How am I supposed to?"
"You've got a goddamn furnace on E-level," Stackhouse roared. "Use the fucking thing for something besides kids." He hung up and used the landline to call fellows in the computer room. Andy wanted to know what the alarm was about. He sounded scared. "We have a problem in back half, but I'm handling it. Feed the cameras from over there to my computer. Don't ask questions, just do it." He turned on his desktop. Had the elderly thing ever booted up so slowly? And clicked on security cameras. He saw the front half cafeteria, mostly empty, a few kids in the playground. "Andy," he shouted, "not front half, back half. Stop fucking around." The picture flipped, and he saw Heckle through a film of lens dust, cowering in his office just as Jekyll came in, presumably from her interrupted meditation session. She was looking back over her shoulder. "Okay, that's better. I'll take it from here." He flipped the image and saw the caretaker's lounge. A bunch of them were cowering in there with the door of the corridor closed and presumably locked. No help there. Flip, and here was the blue-carpeted main corridor, with at least three caretakers down. No, make it four. Jake Howland was sitting on the floor outside the screening room, cradling his hand against his smock top, which was drenched with blood. Flip, and here was the cafeteria, empty. Flip, and here was the lounge. Corinne Rawson was kneeling next to Phil Chaffetz, babbling to someone on her walkie-talkie. Phil did indeed look dead. Flip, and here was the elevator lobby, the door to the elevator just beginning to slide shut. The car was the size of those used to transport patients in hospitals, and it was crammed with residents, most undressed. The Gorks from Ward A, then. If he could stop them there, trap them there. Flip, and through that irritating film of dust and smear, Stackhouse saw more kids on E-level, close to a dozen, milling around in front of the elevator doors and waiting for them to open and disgorge the rest of the kitty mutineers, waiting outside the access tunnel leading to front half. Not good. Stackhouse picked up the landline and heard nothing but silence. Fellows had hung up on his end. Cursing the wasted time, Stackhouse dialed him back.
Can you kill the power to the back half elevator? Stop it in the shaft?
I don't know, Fellows said. Maybe. It might be in the emergency procedures booklet. Just let me check.
But it was already too late. The elevator doors slid open on E-level and the escapees from Gorky Park wandered out, staring around at the tiled elevator lobby as if there was something to see there. That was bad, but Stackhouse saw something worse. Heckle and Jekyll could collect dozens of back-half keycards and burn them, but it would make no difference. Because one of the kids, it was the pipsqueak who'd collaborated with the housekeeper on Ellis's escape, had an orange keycard in his hand. It would open the door to the tunnel, and it would also open the door that gave on F-level in front half. If they got to front half, anything might happen. For a moment, one that seemed endless, Stackhouse froze. Fellows was squawking in his ear, but the sound was far away. Because yes, the little shit was using the orange card and leading his merry band into the tunnel. A 200-yard walk would take them to front half. The door closed behind the last of them, leaving the lower elevator lobby empty. Stackhouse flipped to a new camera and got them walking along the tiled tunnel. Dr. Hendricks came bursting in. Good old Donkey Kong with his shirt tail flapping and his fly half-zipped and his eyes all red-rimmed and buggy.
What's happening? What's...
And just to add to the lunacy, his box phone began its brr, brr, brr. Stackhouse held his hand up to silence Hendricks. The box phone continued its demands.
Andy, they're in the tunnel. They're coming and they have a key card. We need to stop them. Do you have any ideas at all?
He expected nothing but more panic. But Fellows surprised him.
I guess I could kill the locks.
What?
I can't deactivate the cards, but I can freeze the locks. The entry codes are computer-generated, and so...
Are you saying you can bottle them up?
Well, yes.
Do it. Do it right now.
What is it?
Hendricks asked.
Jesus, I was just getting ready to leave, and the alarm...
Shut up, Stackhouse said. But stay here, I may need you.
The box phone continued braying. Still watching the tunnel and the marching morons, he picked it up. Now he was holding a phone to each ear, like a character in some old slapstick comedy.
What? What?
We are here, and the boy is here, Mrs. Sigsby said.
The connection was good. She might have been in the next room.
I expect to have him back in our custody shortly.
She paused.
Or dead.
Good for you, Julia, but we have a situation here. There's been a...
Whatever it is, handle it. This is happening now. I'll call you when we're on our way out of town.
She was gone. Stackhouse didn't care. Because if Fellows didn't work computer magic, Julia might have nothing to come back to.
Andy, are you still there?
I'm here.
Did you do it?
Stackhouse felt a dreadful certainty that Fellows would say that their old computer system had picked this critical moment to seize up.
Yes.
Well, pretty sure. I'm looking at a message on my screen that says orange key cards invalid, insert new authorization code.
A pretty sure from Andy Fellows did jack shit to ease Stackhouse's mind. He sat forward in his chair, hands locked together, watching the screen of his computer. Hendricks joined him, peering over his shoulder.
My God, what are they doing out?
Coming for us would be my guess, Stackhouse said. We're about to find out if they can.
The parade of potential escapees left the view of one camera. Stackhouse punched the key that swapped the images, briefly got Corinne Rawson holding Phil's head in her lap, then got the one he wanted. It showed the door to F-level on the front half end of the access tunnel. The kids reached it.
Crunch time, Stackhouse said.
He was clenching his fists hard enough to leave marks in his palms. Dixon raised the orange card and laid it on the reader pad. He tried the knob, and when nothing happened, Trevor Stackhouse finally relaxed. Beside him, Hendricks gusted out a breath that smelled strongly of bourbon. Drinking on duty was as verboten as carrying a cell phone, but Stackhouse wasn't going to worry about that now. Flies in a jar, he thought. That's all you are now, boys and girls. As to what happens to you next, that, thankfully, wasn't his problem.
What happened to them after the loose end in South Carolina had been snipped off was up to Mrs. Sigsby. That's why they pay you the big bucks, Julia, he said, and settled back in his chair to watch a bunch of the kids, now led by Wilhelm, go back and try the door they had come through, with no result. The Wilhelm brat threw back his head. His mouth opened. Stackhouse wished for audio, so he could hear that scream of frustration. We have contained the problem, he said to Hendricks. Hendricks said. Stackhouse turned to look at him. What does that mean?
Maybe not quite.
28. Tim put a hand on Luke's shoulder. If you feel up to it now, we really need to go back inside and sort this out. We'll get you that Coke and...
Wait. Luke was staring at the hand-holding couple crossing the street.
They hadn't noticed the trio standing at the mouth of Orphan Annie's alley. Their attention was focused on the cop shop.
Got off the interstate and got lost, Wendy said. Bet you anything. We get half a dozen a month. Want to go back in now?
Luke paid no attention. He could still sense the others, the kids, and they sounded dismayed now. But they were far back in his mind, like voices coming through a ventilator from another room. That woman, the one in the flowery dress. Something falls over and wakes me up. It must be the trophy from when we won the Northwest debate tourney, because that's the biggest and it makes a hell of a clatter. Someone is bending over me. I say mom because even though I know it isn't her, she's a woman and mom is the first word to come into my still mostly asleep mind. And she says,
Sure, Luke said. Whatever you want.
Great, Wendy said.
We'll just...
No, that's what she said, he pointed. The couple had reached the sidewalk in front of the sheriff's station. They were no longer holding hands. Luke turned to Tim, his eyes wide and panicky.
She's one of the ones who took me. I saw her again, in the institute, in the break room. They're here, I told you they'd come, and they're here!
Luke whirled and ran for the door, which was unlocked on this side, so Annie could get in late at night, should she so desire.
What?
Wendy began, but Tim didn't let her finish. He ran after the boy from the train, and the thought in his mind was that just maybe the kid had been right about Norbert Hollister, after all. 29.
Well?
Orphan Annie's whisper was almost too fierce to be called one.
Do you believe me now, Mr. Corbett Denton?
Drummer didn't reply at first, because he was trying to process what he was looking at. Three vans parked side by side, and beyond them, a cluster of men and women. Looked like nine of them, enough to field a damn baseball team. And Annie was right. They were armed. It was twilight now, but the light lingered long in late summer, and besides, the streetlights had come on. Drummer could see holstered sidearms and two long guns that looked to him like HKs, people-killing machines. The baseball team was clustered near the front of the old movie theater, but mostly shielded from the sidewalk by its brick flank. They were obviously waiting for something.
They got scouts,
Annie hissed.
See them crossing the street? They'll be checking the sheriffs to see how many are in there. Will you get your goddamn guns now, or do I have to go get them myself?
Drummer turned, and for the first time in 20 years, maybe even 30, broke into a full-out run. He mounted the steps to the apartment over his barber shop and stopped on the landing long enough to tear in 3 or 4 huge breaths, also long enough to wonder if his heart would be able to stand the strain or if it would simply explode. His .30-06, which he planned to shoot himself with one of these fine South Carolina nights, might have done it already if not for an occasional interesting conversation with the town's new night knocker, was in the closet, and it was loaded. So were the .45 automatic pistol and .38 revolver on the high shelf. He took all three weapons and ran back down the stairs, panting and sweating and probably stinking like a hog in a steam bath, but feeling fully alive for the first time in years. He listened for the sound of shooting. but so far there was nothing. Maybe they're cops, he thought, but that seemed unlikely. Cops would have walked right in, showed their IDs, and announced their business. Also, they would have come in black SUVs, Suburbans, or Escalades. At least that was the way they did it on TV. Nick Wilhelm led the ragtag troop of lost boys and girls back down the slightly slanted tunnel to the locked door on the front half side. Some of the Ward A inmates followed. Some just milled around. Pete Littlejohn began to hit the top of his head again, yelling, "Yeah, yeah, 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 yeah." There was an echo in the tunnel that made his rhythmic chant not just annoying, but maddening. "Join hands," Nicky said. "All of us." He lifted his chin to indicate the milling gorks and added, "I think it will bring them." "Like bugs to a bug light," Kalisha thought. It wasn't very nice, but the truth so seldom was. They came. As each one joined the circle, the hum became louder. The sides of the tunnel forced their circle into more of a capsule shape, but that was okay. The power was here. Kalisha understood what Nicky was thinking, not just because she was picking it up, but because it was the only play they had left. "Stronger together," she thought. And then, out loud to Avery, "Bust that lock, Avester." The hum rose to that feedback scream. And if any one of them had still had a headache, it would have fled in terror. Once again, Kalisha had that sense of sublime power. It came on sparkler nights, but then it was dirty. This was clean, because it was them. The Ward A children were silent, but smiling. They felt it, too, and liked it. Kalisha supposed it was the closest to thinking they might ever get. There was a faint creaking noise from the door, and they could see it settle back in its frame, but that was all. Avery had been standing on his tiptoes, his small face clenched in concentration. Now he slumped and let out his breath. George? No. Avery? No. If it was just locked, I think we could, but it's like the lock isn't even there.
Dead, Iris said. Dead. Dead. Can't be fed. That's what I said. The lock is dead.
Froze them somehow, Nicky said. And we can't bust through, can we? Avery.
No. Solid steel.
Where's Superman when you need him? George said. He scrubbed his hands up his cheeks, producing a humorless smile. Helen sat down, put her hands to her face, and began to cry.
What good are we?
She said it again, this time as a mental echo.
What good are we?
Nicky turned to Kalisha. Any ideas?
No.
He turned to Avery. What about you? Avery shook his head.
31. What do you mean, not quite? Stackhouse asked. Instead of answering, Donkey Kong hurried across the room to Stackhouse's intercom. The top of the casing was thick with dust. Stackhouse had never used it a single time. It wasn't as if he had to announce upcoming dances or trivia nights. Dr. Hendricks bent to inspect the rudimentary controls and flicked a switch, lighting a green go lamp. What do you mean? It was Hendricks' turn to say shut up, and instead of being angry, Stackhouse felt a certain admiration. Whatever the good doctor was up to, he thought it was important. Hendricks took the microphone, then paused.
Is there a way to make sure those escaped children don't hear what I'm going to say? No sense giving them ideas.
There are no speakers in the access tunnel, Stackhouse said, hoping he was correct about that. As for back half, I believe they have their own separate intercom system. What are you up to? Hendricks looked at him as if he were an idiot.
Just because their bodies are locked up, that doesn't mean their minds are.
Oh, shit, Stackhouse thought. I forgot what they're here for.
Now how does this... Never mind, I see.
Hendricks depressed the button on the side of the mic, cleared his throat, and began to speak.
Attention, please. All staff, attention. This is Dr. Hendricks.
He ran a hand through his thinning hair, making what had been crazy to begin with crazier still.
Children have escaped from back half, but there is no cause for alarm. I repeat, no cause for alarm. They are penned up in the access tunnel between front half and back half. They may attempt to influence you, however. The way they... He paused, licking his lips. The way they influence certain people when they do their jobs. They may attempt to make you harm yourselves, or, well, to turn you against one another. Oh, Jesus, Stackhouse thought. There's a cheerful idea. Listen carefully, Hendricks said. They are only able to succeed in such mental infiltration if the targets are unsuspecting. If you feel something, if you sense thoughts that are not your own, remain calm and resist them. Expel them. You will be able to do this quite easily. It may help to speak aloud, to say, I am not listening to you. He started to put the mic down, but Stackhouse took it. This is Stackhouse. Front half personnel. All children must go back to their rooms immediately. If any resist, zap them. He flicked off the intercom and turned to Hendricks. Maybe the little fucks in the tunnel won't think of it. They're only children, after all.
Oh, they'll think of it, Hendricks said. After all, they've had practice.
32. Tim overtook Luke as the boy opened the door to the holding area.
Stay here, Luke.
Wendy, you're with me.
You don't really think...
I don't know what I think. Don't draw your gun, but make sure the strap is off. As Tim and Wendy hurried up the short aisle between the four empty cells, they heard a man's voice. He sounded pleasant enough. Good-humored, even. My wife and I were told there are some interesting old buildings in Beaufort, and we thought we'd take a shortcut. But our GPS kind of screwed the pooch.
I made him stop to ask for directions, the woman said.
And as Tim entered the office, he saw her looking up at her husband, if that was what the blonde man really was, with amused exasperation.
He didn't want to. Men always think they know where they're going, don't they?
I tell you what, we're a little busy just now, Sheriff John said, and I don't have time.
It's her!
Luke shouted from behind Tim and Wendy, making them both jump. The other officers looked around. Luke shoved past Wendy hard enough to make her stagger against the wall.
She's the one who sprayed me in the face and knocked me out! You bitch, you killed my parents!
He tried to run at her. Tim caught him by the neck of his shirt and yanked him back. The blonde man and the flower dress woman looked surprised and puzzled. Completely normal, in other words. Except Tim thought he'd seen another expression on the woman's face just for an instant. A look of narrow recognition.
I think there's some kind of mistake, she was saying.
She tried on a bewildered smile.
Who is this boy? Is he crazy?
Although he was only the town night knocker, and would be for the next 5 months, Tim reverted to cop mode without thinking, as he had on the night those kids had stuck up the zonies and shot Absamil Dobira. I'd like to see your IDs, folks.
Really, there's no need of that, is there?
The woman said.
I don't know who that boy thinks we are, but we're lost. And when I was a little girl, my mom used to tell me that if you get lost, ask a policeman.
Sheriff John stood up.
That may be true, and if it is, you won't mind showing us your driver's licenses, will you?
Not at all, the man said. Just let me get my wallet. The woman was already reaching into her purse, looking exasperated.
Look out! Luke shouted. They have guns!
Tag Faraday and George Burkett looked astounded. Frank Potter and Bill Wicklow perplexed.
Whoa, a second, Sheriff John said. Hands where I can see them.
Neither of them paused. Michelle Robertson's hand came out of her purse, holding not her driver's license, but the Sig Sauer Nightmare Micro she had been issued. Denny Williams had reached behind him for the Glock in his belt rather than his wallet. Both the sheriff and Deputy Faraday were reaching for their service weapons, but they were slow. Slow. Tim was not. He pulled Wendy's gun from her holster and pointed it with both hands.
Drop the weapons. Drop them.
They did not. Robertson aimed at Luke, and Tim shot her a single time, driving her backward against one of the station's big double doors, hard enough to crack the frosted glass. Williams dropped to one knee and aimed at Tim, who had just time to think, this guy's a pro and I'm dead. But the man's gun jerked upward, as if pulled by an invisible cord.
and the bullet meant for Tim went into the ceiling. Sheriff John Ashworth punted the blonde man on the side of the head, sending him sprawling. Billy Wicklow stomped on his wrist.
Give it up, motherfucker, just give it.
That was when Mrs. Sigsby, realizing things had gone wrong, told Lewis Grant and Tom Jones to open up with the big guns. Williams and Robertson weren't important. The boy was. 33. The two HK-37s filled Dupre's formerly peaceful twilight with thunder. Grant and Jones raked the brick front of the sheriff's station, raising puffs of pinkish-red dust, blowing the windows and the glass door panels inward. They were on the sidewalk. The rest of Gold Team was standing spread out behind them in the street. The only exception was Dr. Evans, standing off to one side, his hands over his ears.
Yeah!
Winona Briggs shouted. She was dancing from foot to foot as if she needed to go to the bathroom.
Kill their asses!
Go! Mrs. Sigsby shouted. All of you, go now! Take the boy or kill him! Take him or...
Then from behind them,
You're not going anywhere, ma'am. I swear by the Savior a bunch of you gon' be dead if you try. You two fellas up front, put down those grease guns this minute.
Lewis Grant and Tom Jones turned, but did not put down the HKs.
Do it fast, Annie said, or you're dead. This isn't playing, boys. You're in the South now.
They looked at each other, then put the autos carefully down on the pavement. Mrs. Sigsby saw two unlikely ambushers standing beneath the gem's sagging marquee, a fat bald man in a pajama top, and a wild-haired woman in what looked like a Mexican serape. The man had a rifle. The woman in the serape had an automatic in one hand and a revolver in the other.
Now the rest of you folks do the same, Drummer Denton said. You're covered.
Mrs. Sigsby looked at the two yokels standing in front of the abandoned theater, and her thought was both simple and weary. Would this never end? A gunshot from inside the sheriff's station, a brief pause, then another. When the yokels glanced that way, Grant and Jones bent to pick up their weapons.
Don't you do it!
The woman in the serape shouted. Robin Lex, who not so long ago had shot Luke's father through a pillow, took that small window of opportunity to draw her SIG Micro. The other members of Gold Team dropped to give Grant and Jones a clear field of fire. This was how they'd been taught to react. Mrs. Sigsby stood where she was, as if her anger at this unexpected problem would protect her. 34. As the confrontation in South Carolina began, Kalisha and her friends were sitting in slumped postures of disconsolation near the access door to front half, the door they couldn't open because Iris was right. The lock was dead. Nikki, maybe we can still do something. Get the staff in front half the way we got the red caretakers. Avery was shaking his head. He looked less like a little boy and more like a weary old man.
I tried. Reached out to Gladys because I hate her. Her and her fake smile. She said she wasn't listening and pushed me away.
Kalisha looked at the Ward A kids, who were once more wandering off, as if there were anywhere to go. A girl was doing cartwheels. A boy wearing filthy board shorts and a torn t-shirt was knocking his head lightly against the wall. Pete Littlejohn was still getting his yah-yahs out. But they would come if called, and there was plenty of power there. She took Avery's hand.
All of us together.
No,
Avery said. We might be able to make them feel a little weird, dizzy and sick to their stomachs, but that's all.
Kalisha.
But why? Why? If we could kill that bomb-making guy way over in Afghanistan.
Avery.
Because the bomb-making guy didn't know. The preacher, that Weston guy, he doesn't know. When they know.
George.
They can keep us out.
Avery nodded.
Then what can we do?
Helen asked.
Anything?
Avery shook his head.
I don't know. There's one thing, Kalisha said. We're stuck here, but we know someone who isn't. But we'll need everybody.
She tilted her head toward the wandering exiles from Ward A.
Let's call them. I don't know, Shaw, Avery said. I'm pretty tired.
Just this one more thing, she coaxed. Avery sighed and held out his hands. Kalisha, Nikki, George, Helen, and Katie linked up. After a moment, Iris did too. Once again, the others drifted to them. They made the capsule shape, and the hum rose. In front half, caretakers and techs and janitors felt it and feared it. But it wasn't directed at them. 1,400 miles away, Tim had just put a bullet between Michelle Robertson's breasts. Grant and Jones were just raising their automatic rifles to rake the front of the sheriff's station. Billy Wicklow was standing on Denny Williams' hand with Sheriff John beside him. The children of the Institute called out to Luke. 35. Luke didn't think about reaching out with his mind to knock the blonde man's gun up. He just did it. The Stasi lights came back, momentarily blotting out everything. When they began to fade, he saw one of the cops standing on the blonde man's wrist, trying to make him let go of the gun in his hand. The blonde man's lips were stretched in a snarl of pain, and blood was pouring down the side of his face, but he was holding on. The sheriff brought his foot back, apparently meaning to kick the blonde man in the head again. Luke saw this much, but then the Stasi lights returned, brighter than ever, and the voices of his friends hit him like a hammer blow in the middle of his head. He stumbled backward through the doorway to the holding area, raising his hands as if to ward off a punch, and tripped over his own feet. He landed on his butt just as Grant and Jones opened up with their automatic rifles. He saw Tim tackle Wendy and bring her to the floor, shielding her body with his own. He saw bullets tear into the sheriff and the deputy standing on the blonde man's hand. They both went down. Glass flew. Somebody was screaming. Luke thought it was Wendy. Outside, Luke heard the woman who sounded weirdly like Mrs. Sigsby shout something that sounded like, "All of you, now!" For Luke, dazed from a double dose of the Stasi lights and the combined voices of his friends, the world seemed to slow down. He saw one of the other deputies, wounded, there was blood running down his arm, pivot toward the broken main doors, probably to see who had been shooting. He seemed to be moving very slowly. The blonde man was getting to his knees, and he also seemed to be moving slowly. It was like watching an underwater ballet. He shot the deputy in the back, then began turning toward Luke. Faster now, the world speeding up again. Before the blonde man could fire, the red-headed deputy bent down, almost bowing, and shot him in the temple. The blonde man flew sideways and landed on top of the woman who had claimed to be his wife. A woman outside, not the one who sounded like Mrs. Sigsby, another one with a southern accent, shouted, "Don't you do it!" More gunfire followed. And then the first woman yelled, "The boy! We have to get the boy!" "It is her," Luke thought. "I don't know how it can be, but it is. That's Mrs. Sigsby out there." 36. Robin Lex was a good shot, but the twilight was deepening and the distance was long for a handgun as small as the Micro. Her bullet got Drummer Denton high in the shoulder instead of hitting him center mass. It drove him back against the boarded-up box office, and her next two shots went wild.
Orphan Annie stood her ground. She had been raised that way in the Georgia canebrakes by a father who told her, "You don't back down, girl, not for nothing." Jean Ledoux had been a crack shot, whether drunk or sober, and he had taught her well. Now she opened fire with both of Drummer's handguns, compensating for the .45 Auto's heavier recoil without even thinking about it. She took down one of the automatic riflemen.
It was Tony Fazeli, who would never wield a zap stick again.
Never minding the three or four bullets that whizzed past her, one of them giving a flirty little flick to the hem of her serape.
Drummer came back and aimed at the woman who had shot him. Robin was down on one knee in the middle of the street, cursing her SIG, which had jammed. Drummer socked the .30-06 into the hollow of the shoulder that wasn't bleeding and put her down the rest of the way.
"Stop shooting!" Mrs. Sigsby was screaming. "We have to get the boy. We have to make sure of the boy. Tom Jones, Alice Green, Lewis Grant, wait for me, Josh Gottfried, Winona Briggs, hold steady."
Drummer and Annie looked at each other.
"Do we keep shooting or not?"
Annie asked.
"Fuck if I know," Drummer said.
Tom Jones and Alice Green were flanking the battered doors of the sheriff's station. Josh Gottfried and Winona Briggs walked backward, likewise flanking Mrs. Sigsby and keeping their guns on the unexpected shooters who had blindsided them. Dr. James Evans, who had not been assigned a position, assigned his own. He walked past Mrs. Sigsby and approached Drummer and Orphan Annie with his hands raised and a placating smile on his face.
"Get back here, you fool," Mrs. Sigsby snapped.
He ignored her.
"I'm not part of this,"
he said, speaking to the fat man in the pajama top, who looked to be the saner of the two ambushers.
"I never wanted to be part of this, so I think I'll just..." "Oh, sit down," Annie said, and shot him in the foot. She was considerate enough to do it with the .38, which would cause less damage. In theory, at least. That left the woman in the red pantsuit the woman in charge. If the shooting started again, she would probably be cut to pieces in the crossfire. But she showed no fear, only a kind of pissed-off concentration. "I'm going into the station now," she said to Drummer and Orphan Annie. "There doesn't need to be any more of this nonsense. Stand pat and you'll be fine. Start shooting and Josh and Winona will take you out. Understood?" She didn't wait for an answer. Simply turned away and walked toward the remains of her force, low heels clacking on the pavement. "Drummer?" Annie said. "What do we do?"
"Maybe we don't have to do anything," he said.
"Look to your left. Don't move your head, just cut your eyes."
She did, and saw one of the Dobira brothers hustling up the sidewalk. He had a pistol. Later, he would tell the state police that although he and his brother were peaceful men, they had thought it wise to keep a gun in the store since the holdup. "Now to the right. Don't move your head." She cut her eyes that way and saw the widow Goolsby and Mr. Bilson, father of the Bilson twins. Addie Goolsby was in her robe and slippers. Richard Bilson was wearing madras shorts and a red crimson tied t-shirt. Both had hunting rifles. The cluster in front of the sheriff's station didn't see them. Their attention was on whatever business they'd come here to transact. "You're in the South now," Annie had told these gunned-up interlopers. She had an idea they were about to find out just how true that was. "Tom and Alice," Mrs. Sigsby said, "go in. Make sure you get the boy." They went.
37. Tim pulled Wendy to her feet. She looked dazed, not entirely sure where she was. There was a shredded piece of paper caught in her hair. The shooting outside had stopped, at least for the moment. It had been replaced by talking. But Tim's ears were ringing, and he couldn't make out the words. And it didn't matter. If they were making peace out there, good. It would be prudent, however, to expect more war. "Wendy, okay?"
Tim, they killed Sheriff John." "How many others?"
He shook her. "Are you okay?" She nodded.
Yes, I think so."
"Take Luke out the back." She reached for him. Luke evaded her and ran for the sheriff's desk. Tag Faraday tried to grab his arm, but Luke evaded him, too. A bullet had clipped the laptop, knocking it askew, but the home screen, although cracked, was still up, and the flash drive's little orange-ready light was blinking steadily. His ears were also ringing, but he was close to the door now and heard Mrs. Sigsby say, "Make sure you get the boy." "Oh, you bitch," he thought. "You relentless bitch." Luke grabbed the laptop and dropped to his knees, cradling it to his chest as Alice Green and Tom Jones came through the shattered double doors. Tag raised his sidearm but took a burst from the HK before he could fire, the back of his uniform shirt shredding. The Glock flew from his hand and spun across the floor. The only other deputy still standing, Frank Potter, never moved to defend himself. There was a stunned, unbelieving expression on his face.
Alice Green shot him once in the head, then ducked as more gunfire erupted in the street behind them. There were yells and a scream of pain. The gunfire and the scream momentarily distracted the man with the HK. Jones wheeled in that direction and Tim double-tapped him, one in the back of the neck and the other in the head. Alice Green straightened and came on, stepping over Jones, her face set, and now Tim saw another woman crowding in behind her. An older woman wearing a red pantsuit, also holding a gun. Dear Christ, he thought, how many are there? Did they send an army for one little boy?
He's behind the desk, Alice, the older woman said.
Considering the carnage, she sounded eerily calm.
I can see a bandage on his ear sticking up. Pull him out and shoot him.
The woman named Alice came around the desk. Tim didn't bother telling her to stop. They were way past that, only pulled the trigger of Wendy's Glock. It clicked dry. Although there should have been at least one more round in the clip, probably two. Even in this do-or-die moment, he understood the reason. Wendy hadn't fully reloaded after the last time she took target practice with it on the gun range over in Dunning. Such things were not high on her list of priorities. He even had time to think, as he had during his early days in Dupre, that Wendy had never been cut out to be a cop. Should have stuck to dispatch, he thought. But too late now. I think we're all going to die. Luke rose up from behind the dispatch desk, the laptop held in both hands. He swung it and hit Alice Green full in the face. The cracked screen shattered. Green staggered back into the woman in the pantsuit, her nose and mouth bleeding, then raised her gun again.
Drop it, drop it, drop it!
Wendy screamed. She had scooped up Tag Faraday's Glock. Green took no notice. She was aiming at Luke, who was pulling Maureen Alverson's flash drive from the laptop's port instead of ducking for cover. Wendy fired three times, eyes slitted, uttering a shrill cry with each trigger pull. The first bullet took Alice Green just above the bridge of her nose. The second went through one of the empty holes in the door where a frosted glass panel had been only 150 seconds before. The third struck Julia Sigsby in the leg. Her gun flew from her hand and she folded to the floor, a look of unbelief on her face.
You shot me. Why did you shoot me? Are you stupid? Why do you think?
Wendy said. She walked to the woman sitting against the wall, her shoes crunching on broken glass. The air stank of gunpowder, and the office, once neat, now a shambles, was filled with drifting blue smoke.
You were telling them to shoot the kid.
Mrs. Sigsby gave her the sort of smile reserved for those who must suffer fools.
You don't understand. How could you? He belongs to me. He's property.
Not anymore, Tim said. Luke knelt beside Mrs. Sigsby. There were spatters of blood on his cheeks and a shard of glass in one eyebrow. Who did you leave in charge at the Institute? Stackhouse? Is he the one? She only looked at him. Is it Stackhouse? Nothing. Drummer Denton stepped in and looked around. His pajama shirt was soaked with blood down one side, but he looked remarkably alert in spite of that. Gutali Dobira was peering over his shoulder, eyes wide.
Holy shit, Drummer said. It's a massacre.
I had to shoot a man, Gutali said. Mrs. Goolsby. She was shooting a woman who was trying to shoot her. It was a clear case of self-defense.
How many outside? Tim asked them. Are they all down or are some still active? Annie pushed Gutali Dobira aside and stood next to Drummer. In her serape with a smoking gun in each hand, she looked like a character from a spaghetti western. Tim wasn't surprised. He was beyond surprise.
I believe everyone who got out of those vans is accounted for, she said. A couple wounded, one with a bullet in his foot, one hurt bad. That was the one Dobira shot. The rest of the sons of bitches look like they're dead in here.
She surveyed the room.
And Christ, who's left in the sheriff's department?
Wendy, Tim thought but did not say. I guess she's the acting sheriff now. Or maybe Ronnie Gibson will be when she comes back from vacation. Probably Ronnie. Wendy won't want the job. Addie Goolsby and Richard Bilson were now standing with Gutali behind Annie and Drummer. Bilson surveyed the main room with dismay. Bullet-riddled walls, broken glass, pools of blood on the floor, sprawled bodies, and put a hand to his mouth. Addy was made of sterner stuff.
Doc's on his way. Half the town's out there in the street, most of them armed. What happened here? And who is that?
She pointed at the skinny boy with the bandage on his ear. Luke took no notice. He was fixated on the woman in the pantsuit.
Stackhouse, sure. Has to be. I need to get in touch with him. How do I do that?
Mrs. Sigsby only stared at him. Tim knelt beside Luke. What he saw in the pantsuit woman's eyes was pain, disbelief, and hate. He couldn't be sure which of those predominated, but if forced to guess, he would have said hate. It was always the strongest, at least in the short term. Luke paid no attention. All of his attention was focused on the wounded woman.
I need to get in touch with him, Mrs. Sigsby. He's holding my friends prisoner.
They're not prisoners. They're property.
Wendy joined them.
I'm thinking you must have been absent on the day your class learned about Lincoln freeing the slaves, ma'am.
Come in here, shooting up our town, Annie said. Guess you found out, didn't you?
Hush, Annie,
Wendy said. I need to get in touch with him, Mrs. Sigsby. I need to make a deal.
Tell me how to do it.
When she didn't reply, Luke jammed his thumb into the bullet hole in her red pants. Mrs. Sigsby shrieked.
Don't! Oh, don't! That hurts!
Zapsticks hurt, Luke shouted at her.
Glass shards rattled across the floor, forming small creaks. Annie stared, eyes wide with fascination.
Injections hurt. Being half-drowned hurts. And having your mind ripped open?
He jammed his thumb against the bullet wound again. The door to the holding area slammed shut, making them all jump.
Having your mind destroyed? That hurts most of all.
Make him stop, Mrs. Sigsby screamed. Make him stop hurting me.
Wendy bent to pull Luke away. Tim shook his head and took her arm. No.
It's a conspiracy,
Annie whispered to Drummer. Her eyes were huge.
That woman works for the conspiracy. They all do. I knew it all along. I said it, and nobody believed me.
The ringing in Tim's ears was starting to fade. He heard no sirens, which didn't surprise him. He guessed the Stadies might not even know there had been a shootout in Dupre, at least not yet. And anyone calling 911 would have reached not the South Carolina Highway Patrol, but the Fairleigh County Sheriff. This shambles, in other words. He glanced at his watch and saw with disbelief that the world had been right side up only 5 minutes ago. 6 at most. Mrs. Sigsby, is it? He asked, kneeling beside Luke. She said nothing. You were in a great deal of trouble, Mrs. Sigsby. I advise you to tell Luke here what he wants to know.
I need medical attention.
Tim shook his head. What you need is to do some talking. Then we'll see about medical attention.
Luke was telling the truth,
Wendy said to no one in particular.
About everything.
Didn't I just say that?
Annie almost crowed.
Doc Roper pushed his way into the office.
Holy Jesus on Resurrection Morn, he said. Who's still alive? How badly is that woman hurt? Was it some kind of terrorist thing?
They're torturing me, Mrs. Sigsby said. If you are a doctor, as that black bag you're carrying would seem to suggest, you have an obligation to make them stop.
Tim said, The boy you treated was running away from this woman and the raiding party she brought with her, Doc. I don't know how many are dead out there, but we lost 5, including the sheriff, and it was on this woman's orders.
We'll deal with that later, Roper said. Right now, I need to take care of her. She's bleeding, and somebody needs to call a goddamn ambulance.
Mrs. Sigsby looked at Luke, bared her teeth in a smile that said, I win, then looked back at Roper.
Thank you, doctor. Thank you.
There's a biddy with sand in her craw,
Annie said, and not without admiration.
Fella I shot in the foot, maybe not so much. I'd go see him, or I you. I think he'd sell his own grandma into white slavery for a shot of morphine.
Mrs. Sigsby's eyes widened in alarm.
Leave him alone. I forbid you to talk to him.
Tim got to his feet. Forbid and be damned. I don't know who you work for, lady, but I believe your days of kidnapping children are over. Luke, Wendy, come with me. 38. House lights had come on all over town. and Dupre's main street was full of milling people. The bodies of the dead were being covered by whatever came to hand. Someone had taken Orphan Annie's sleeping bag out of the alley and draped it over Robin Lex. Dr. Evans had been completely forgotten. He could conceivably have limped his way to one of the parked mom vans and gotten away, but had made no effort to do so. Tim, Wendy, and Luke found him sitting on the curb in front of the gym. His cheeks gleamed with tears. He had managed to work his shoe off and was now staring at a bloody sock covering what looked like a badly deformed foot. How much of that was bone damage and how much swelling that would eventually go down, Tim neither knew nor cared. "What is your name, sir?" Tim asked.
"Never mind my name. I want a lawyer. And I want a doctor. A woman shot me. I want her arrested."
"His name is James Evans," Luke said, "and he's a doctor, just like Joseph Mengele was." Evans seemed to notice Luke for the first time. He pointed at the boy with a trembling finger.
"This is all your fault."
Luke lunged at Evans, but this time Tim held him back and pushed him gently but firmly to Wendy, who took him by the shoulders. Tim squatted on his hunkers so he could look the pallid, frightened man dead in the eye. "Listen to me, Dr. Evans. Listen closely. You and your friends came high-riding into town to get this boy and killed 5 people, all police officers. Now, you might not know it, but South Carolina has the death penalty, and if you think they won't use it and double quick for killing a county sheriff and 4 deputies..."
"I had nothing to do with it,"
Evans squawked.
"I was here under protest. I..."
"Shut up," Wendy said. She still had the late Tag Faraday's Glock, and now she pointed it at the foot that was still shod.
"Those officers were also my friends. If you think I'm going to read you your rights or something, you're out of your goddamn mind. What I'm going to do, if you don't tell Luke what he wants, is put a bullet in your other..." all right, yes."
Evans reached down and put protective hands over his good foot, which almost made Tim feel sorry for him. Almost.
"What is it?"